All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All witnesses before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right are Judges Scholin, Bartley, Allen, and Toth. To my left are Judges Peach, Greenberg, and Meredith. We're here today in the matter of Conley F. Monk, Jr. against David J. Shulkin, M.D., Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. I understand that Mr. Monk is present. Mr. Monk, thank you for coming. Docket number 15-1280. The issue before us comes as a petition for extraordinary relief in the nature of a writ of mandamus to correct the Secretary's delay in adjudicating disability claims pending appeal. The petitioner, on behalf of himself and all others similarly situated, challenges the delays in the Secretary's process of adjudicating administrative appeals as unlawful and an unconstitutional denial of procedural due process because it simply takes too long to get a decision from the VA. Each petitioner filed a claim with the Department of Veterans Affairs for disability compensation benefits. The VA denied the claims. Each petitioner timely filed a notice of disagreement. All petitioners have waited more than 12 months for the VA to issue a decision in response to their notices of disagreement. Petitioners allege that they, while they wait, they are being denied crucial benefits to which they may be entitled. The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit held that this court has authority to certify a class for class action and to maintain similar aggregate resolution procedures. We're here today to entertain oral argument on the question, among others, of the framework for class aggregation in this case. On October 26, 2017, the court issued an order to the parties and amici detailing questions to be addressed for the purpose of supplemental briefing and oral argument. By the way, I would like to thank the parties and amici for the high quality of their briefs submitted. Our focus today will largely be on the question contained in the October order regarding certification of a class. To the extent that the merits of the petition and the remedy sought by the petitioners bears on the issue of class aggregation, the parties should be prepared to address those issues as well. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Good morning. Michael Wishnick, Veterans Legal Services Clinic, Yale Law School. With me today are law student interns Catherine McCarthy, who will speak the opening portion of our presentation, and Jordan Goldberg, who will present the rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lynn Nooner of Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett, also representing the petitioners and having the privilege of appearing together with the Yale Law School Veterans Legal Services Clinic on behalf of Mr. Bartlett.
Welcome.
Good morning, Your Honors. Catherine Hogan for the Secretary, and I'm accompanied by Christopher Wallace, Deputy Chief Counsel.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Each party will have 60 minutes to present your respective arguments. You may take less than that time. You may end up, because of the bench questioning, receive more of that time than that, but that's what we've set aside. Counsel for the petitioner, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. We'd like to reserve 20 minutes for rebuttal to be handled by Mr. Goldberg.
Great. Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Catherine McCarthy, and I'm appearing today on behalf of petitioners. As Chief Judge Davis noted, Petitioner Conley Monk is here with us today, along with his brother. Mr. Monk, would you stand? Thank you. Your Honors, petitioners have 3 points today. First, the severe delays pervading the entire VA benefits process are egregious and unreasonable and rise to the level of extraordinary circumstances warranting this Court's intervention. Second, a Rule 23 class action procedure is the best, if not the only, practical way to resolve these claims. For veterans, for the government, and for this Court, a Rule 23 procedure is manageable and it is efficient, and it also provides unparalleled access to justice for veterans. Finally, the present proposed class meets the requirements of Rule 23 for the purposes of class action aggregation. To return to the first point about the egregiousness of these delays, our petitioners have waited an average of 5 years from their timely filings of notices of disagreement until receiving a decision from the BVA. The average timeline cited by the VA is 6 years from timely filing of a notice of disagreement to receiving a decision by the BVA. There are nearly 500,000 veterans currently mired throughout the VA benefits process. And from 2009 to 2015, 32,000 veterans died waiting for resolution of their claims. Despite an ever-increasing budget over the last decade, the agency has only been losing ground with regard to the timeline for resolving delays.
Counsel, if I can interject, you discussed the systemic delays, but the petitioners that you have put forth seem to be at different phases of the litigation process within the VA. Some have board decisions, some don't. And the VA has said that some of the delay is attributable to their execution of their statutory duties to develop the record or hold hearings or whatever. How does this not undermine your commonality argument?
Your Honor, factual differences underlying similar overarching injury will not defeat commonality. All of these veterans have been waiting for protracted periods of time and suffered severe delays by the VA. As in Parsons v. Ryan, as long as they are, again, suffering the same constitutional harms, here petitioners allege harm to their due process rights, the individual factual differences will not defeat commonality.
But under Walmart, doesn't this preclude the ability to create a common answer to how VA would address these varying stages and different delays and folks that may still need development or have a hearing?
No, Your Honor. The Walmart and Parsons standards that a remedy be executable in a single stroke is apt here. Petitioners are simply asking for an injunction directing adjudication of VA benefits appeals within a one-year timeline. And so the only facts relevant to this inquiry are the date of filing of a notice of disagreement for each veteran, as well as how long they have been waiting and whether they've received a BVA decision in the interim.
But in Walmart, the reasons for the challenges to the hiring and promotion, I guess, processes, the Supreme Court asserted could be myriads of reasons why somebody had not been promoted. Here there could be myriads of reasons why somebody's case has been delayed. So how is this not more like Walmart?
Your Honor, this case is distinguishable from Walmart because they're the people responsible for the challenged actions were individual managers at different Walmart locations that were not under central control. In contrast, in the present case, the different sources for delay throughout the benefits pipeline are regional offices and the Board of Veterans Appeals itself, all of which are under the central control directly of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
So central control overcomes the myriad of reasons that might be the cause of the delay?
In combination with the fact that, more like Parsons v. Ryan, the myriad causes are related to the institutional gross inefficiency, which was found in Veterans for Common Sense v. Shinseki in the Ninth Circuit. It is not a disparate series of reasons, as in Walmart v. Dukes, where some might have been pertaining to discrimination, some might have been for other reasons. Here, it has been cited in past case law, as well as various agency reports, that systemic problems with inefficiency are the underlying cause of the delays throughout the system.
So if I could ask two questions, they're related, but they're not directly on par. First, you, in the briefing and even now, have used the term decision, and you've used it, you've said BVA decision, you've used VA decision. My first question, and this is sort of a direct one, is what decision are you referring to in the class definition?
Your Honor, in the class definition, we are including class members who have filed a notice of disagreement more than 1 year ago and have not received a BVA grant, denial, or remand within 1 year.
So you really are saying that the unconstitutional delay in terms of merit is from the moment of filing a notice of disagreement to receiving a decision from the Board of Veterans' Appeals?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, that, I will tell you, I concur with Judge Davis, Chief Judge Davis, that the briefing in this was excellent across the board. That was not at all clear from your briefing, and that is a critically important point. So going forward, right, there are times that we want to hide things or make things a little bit more vague. This was not one of them, because at least I prepared for this under a quite different set of assumptions, and I think the Secretary was too. And so I just throw that out there for what it's worth, speaking just for me. But my second question is returning to Judge Sholin's questions about Walmart. Is your theory of commonality one that if individual reasons for delay, some of which are not unlawful reasons, and some of which are unlawful reasons, okay? Does it matter to you in terms of certification purposes that might be the case? Because that's really the shorthand version of the Secretary's argument, is that, you know, not all delays are created equal in a sense. So how would you respond to that?
Your Honor, overall, the system has shown egregious delays for all veterans with the average six-year timeline. It's possible that on the margins there's some discussion about individual veterans, but petitioners would defer that discussion for the merits phase, as you referenced, in deciding who exactly is in the class.
If I can just follow up. So rightly or wrongly, you know, the Supreme Court said in Walmart that even though Rule 23A2 says common questions, the real standard is common answers that drive the litigation. If one were to take the position that individual causes of delay matter meritoriously, meaning veteran A is delayed for reason one, which is not unlawful, but veteran B is delayed by reason two, which is, is there a theory on which we can say there remains a common answer to a question that drives the litigation?
Yes, Your Honor. There is both a common fact pattern as well as a common theory. So the common fact pattern, again, is a series of delays at each stage of the VA benefits pipeline for which the VA is directly responsible. The common contentions are the gross inefficiencies throughout the system rather than, for example, budgetary or staffing constraints, again, as cited in Veterans for Common Sense v. Shinseki. And finally, the proposal of the remedy that is an order directing resolution of benefits appeals within 1 year is the so-called single-stroke remedy that would apply and universally benefit all class members.
And so whenever you mentioned that by decision in your class, you mean board decision, you mean that with a single stroke we would require a, if necessary, a board decision if the veteran would agree, would continue to disagree with any SOC that's issued.
Your Honor, could you explain what you mean by if necessary?
Well, that is if it's not granted, if the benefit isn't granted.
That's correct.
Ms. McCarthy, I'd like to pick up on one of Judge Allen's questions regarding the reasons for delay. If there are, let's say there are duty to assist reasons for delay, not an unlawful reason, does that factor into your timeline at all?
Your Honor, first, there are statutory limits as to how much time a veteran can take to complete their steps of the process. A total of 90 days. For example, they have just 60 days to submit a Form 9 in response to a statement of the case. And so for that reason, the majority of the timeline is the burden of the Secretary. However, to your point, should there be a need to, if a veteran indicates they wish to submit supplemental evidence that they're waiting on or have an additional medical exam or something like that, petitioners would actually defer to Secretary's suggestion, which we very much agree with, in footnote 24 of their first brief submitted in January, which indicated that petitioners or people who are in the class should be able to waive their rights under this potential Monk rule in order to extend the timeline beyond 1 year and give them a chance to have further examinations or submit additional evidence.
So I suspect, I for one would be very happy if every veteran in this country had a decision in 12 months. I'm sure every veteran would be happy if they had a decision in 12 months. It would turn the current state of affairs 180 degrees and then where it is now. But is that realistic given the process that needs to occur, particularly regarding getting additional information or medical examinations or whatever the additional requirements are? Is that a realistic request?
Your Honor, petitioners believe that it is a realistic ultimate request. We also acknowledge that it is not reasonable to expect it to happen overnight and that, as in past cases such as Brown v. Giuliani in the Eastern District of New York, it is possible to create a plan with the Secretary to implement a gradual phasing in of this deadline, possibly with interim deadlines or with an overtime shortening deadline from a few years to ultimately reach the goal of 1 year. But ultimately, the one-year timeline, yes, petitioners do believe that is reasonable without skipping any of the statutory steps that are required.
Counsel, as of today, how many veterans do you think are in this category?
It's difficult to say exactly, but a few years ago there were 50,000 veterans who were waiting for 5 years at the board, so it's going to be greater than 50,000.
So every day that passes will be additional members who are within the 1 year, outside the 1 year?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And how do you propose this court enforce 50,000, 55,000 cases?
Your Honor, petitioners do not assume that the Secretary would not comply with an order from this court. However, should the Secretary have trouble meeting the order, this court is well within its power to order contempt, for example, and also to conduct deeper monitoring should it have concerns about the Secretary's ability to comply. For example, as in Brown v. Giuliani, again, this court could appoint a special master where they could delegate some of the monitoring responsibilities. The special master could periodically audit to determine where in the phase-in process the department is, whether they're complying with the regulations, and report to the court occasionally so that the court is aware of what it may need to enforce.
Counsel, isn't what you're asking us to do entirely consistent with what Article III courts have done over the last 50 or 60 years in terms of desegregation, busing, overcrowding of prisons? What's the difference between that situation, which was managed by courts day in and day out, and the situation we have here? Why can't we maintain the integrity of the process by supervising it?
Your Honor, petitioners agree that it is well within this court's authority to.
And what about 1 year? Why was that picked instead of a year and a half or two or 6 months?
Your Honor, to a certain extent, any particular deadline will be somewhat arbitrary. However, 1 year in particular was selected because the VA and the Government Accountability Office, for example, have noted that 3 years is too long. And in Erspamer v. Derwinski, the court noted that a couple years to a few years is also too long. 1 to 2 years may be appropriate on the outside for resolution of benefits delays. And so that is why we selected 1 year.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can I back us up a step for a minute? This court in Harrison provided three reasons why we weren't going to do class actions. One was that we didn't have the authority. Two was that it would be highly unmanageable in the appellate setting. And three was that we have precedential opinions that will suffice. The Secretary has argued that the Federal Circuit in Monk only overruled one of those three reasons, which is that we do have the authority. Do you read the Federal Circuit's decision in Monk as overruling those other two criteria in Harrison? If not, are they still binding precedent on us?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, could you repeat the other two criteria?
Sure, that it's highly unmanageable to do a class action in an appellate setting and that it's not necessary to do it because the court has the ability to issue precedential opinions.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, to the point of precedential decisions which this court has issued in the past do not accomplish nearly the same gains in efficiency and access to justice as a Rule 23 class action would. First, it still requires each individual petitioner wishing to bring themselves under the binding precedential decision to file their own affirmative claim. 86% of veterans are unrepresented before reaching the CAVC, and so it's an unreasonable ask to expect veterans to both follow the CAVC's docket and know what the case is that might apply to them, as well as recognize that it does apply to them and file their own complex petition for mandamus. Second, the VA has a history of strategically mooting out petitioners, as revealed in the facts of this case. And the VA's second response filed just last month. Multiple decisions were issued in the past 3 weeks, mooting petitioners out of the class. And finally, with regard to institutional systemic delay in particular, a class action is uniquely well-suited given the institutional-level fact-finding that it enables, as well as the greater monitoring that it concerns, as recognized in Ebanks v. Shulkin in the Federal Circuit, which said the issue of delay it seems best addressed in the class action context, not in a precedential decision context.
So I'm not sure I understood if you answered the question. Do you think Harrison on those two prongs is still binding precedent on us, or do you read the Federal Circuit's decision as having overruled all of Harrison, or just that one prong that we do have the authority? And if it's still precedent, on what basis will we now overturn it or distinguish it?
Your Honor, we read Monk as explicitly overruling the authority prong.
And not the other two?
Correct.
You mentioned that the Secretary has mooted out some cases. Are you talking about the named other petitioners in this case or just generally mooting out?
Both, Your Honor. So in Monk v. Shulkin before the Federal Circuit, that was brought up, as well as in this present case in the fact patterns updated in the February response submitted by the Secretary.
That they've mooted out some of those
names? Yes, Your Honor.
To get back to your response to Judge Meredith's question with regard to a precedential decision, you said that's the most beneficial access to justice or most efficient access to justice for veterans. Wouldn't that be true in every single case? So how do we distinguish between cases that should be class actions and those that shouldn't? Because we obviously can't have every case be a class action.
Yes, Your Honor. It's particularly appropriate in this case where the main issue is system-wide delays. And so the remedy requested is system-wide reform. And for that reason, it makes sense to have a system-wide case involving multiple petitioners.
Well, I know the Federal Circuit said that in Ebanks as dicta, but haven't there been other cases like Mallon that discuss that when you have to make these sorts of individualized determinations, that maybe a class isn't the right type of vehicle?
Your Honor, the concern that due process is an individualized and flexible concept, yes, was raised in Mellon as well as in Jennings more recently. However, that does not defeat class certification in this case. Given that each petitioner, again, shares the same overarching fact pattern of the gross systemic inefficiencies throughout the VA benefit system, an individual diving into fact patterns is not necessary given the strength of the overarching fact pattern.
But you yourself discussed that certain of the petitioners may have lawful reasons why their cases are delayed. I believe one of the petitioners, Obi, neglected to submit a form for years and years that VA required, although there may be some question as to whether they submitted it or not. That would seem to be an individualized determination that would need to be made. And some of your other petitioners, one has a board decision and it was sent back to perform more medical examinations that are pending right now. So aren't those just another and another individualized determination that would need to be made?
Your Honor, my time has elapsed. May I answer the question?
You want to add 5 minutes.
Thank you.
You may answer that question.
Thank you, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. The factual analysis, again, required at the stage of certification, at least, is simply the date of the notice of disagreement, and then whether more than a year has passed since that date without that veteran having received a decision. Whether the particularities of an individual's case, again, push them to the margins such that they are no longer in the class is an issue for the merits phase for determination of who exactly does belong to the class.
So I'm going to follow up on Judge Schoen's question, but I want to ask one other to follow up on the question I think you were talking to Judge Peach about. Are you conceding that some of the petitioner's claims are mooted?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so they're different than what the Federal Circuit determined in Monk itself about Mr. Monk's claim? So because the Federal Circuit held that Mr. Monk's claim was not mooted.
That's true, Your Honor.
Okay, so which particular petitioners are you claiming are moot?
So, Your Honor, I apologize. I might have misspoken a little bit, but petitioners Merrick and Wood, for example, have received BVA decisions. They did still wait for more than a year to receive those decisions.
Okay, so let me. I want to get this right because
yes.
I have a law clerk somewhere in the room writing this down for me, which is which of the petitioners do you concede have had their claims mooted?
Petitioners Wood and Merrick, Your Honor.
And not Mr. Monk, who also received a board decision?
Your Honor, Mr. Monk filed an additional notice of disagreement in 2015 that he has still been waiting on for more than a year, so no, he is not mooted out of the class.
Okay, so but you do agree that the other two are moot even with the holding of the Federal Circuit with respect to Mr. Monk's claim about why that wasn't moot?
Your Honor, yes, Your Honor.
So if somebody has a board decision, they are not part of your class, even if it's a remand that may require a subsequent board decision?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so my follow-up is, with respect to Judge Sherwin's question, about the individual reasons for delay. And I'm going to ask the Secretary the same question, eventually. Don't you have to have as your fundamental point here that regardless of the reason for delay, there is a period of time beyond which it simply is too far? Is that fundamentally what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because it seems to me that's the only way to realistically distinguish Walmart from this situation. In other words, nobody in Walmart had a right to be promoted.
That's correct, Your Honor.
They had reasons that they couldn't be promoted, but that distinguished one reason from another. But so your point would be that there has to be a limit, regardless of whether the reasons are good, bad, indifferent. It doesn't matter.
That's correct, Your Honor. Because petitioners have an entitled property interest to their benefits, they absolutely do have a right, unlike in Walmart v. Dukes.
Ms. McCarthy, your time is about up again, and unless my colleagues have additional questions, I don't intend to extend it further. But I do have a quick question regarding congressional knowledge of the system. Recent This is all in the Secretary's brief, recent reform efforts under the Appeals and Modernization Act, and to the extent that Congress is aware of this system and its delays, what does that say to you regarding the appropriate place for action? Should that be legislative or should that be judicial?
Your Honor, it can be both. Congress's recent action in the Veterans Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act does not preclude this court from acting to also rectify those delays. This court can certainly act in parallel. Congress also had intent in creating this court to compel delayed action by the Secretary. That is not precluded by Congress passing separate legislation. It is not indicated in any way in that legislation that it expects this court to pause in its obligation to compel unreasonably delayed action by the Secretary. VAMA is also not a particularly quick resolution. It will come into effect in 2019. And veterans who wish to take advantage of that by enrolling in the RAMP interim program must actually freeze their appeals and will not get BVA decisions guaranteed until at least 2019. Also, only 1% of invited veterans have enrolled at this point. Finally, VAMA is not only not a quick resolution, it's not a guaranteed resolution. At this point, it is prospective and somewhat speculative to assume that it will have the desired effect, particularly given multiple attempts in the past to rectify the delays for more than a decade that have also failed, and the expressed concerns by the Government Accountability Office and others that this legislation falls prey to the same traps.
I just want to clarify, counsel, were you saying that there is no system-wide policy or procedure that you are claiming violates due process here? Can you target one?
Your Honor, there is no express system-wide policy or procedure. No. There is no, for example, timeline set out that says it will take a certain amount of time. However, we are pointing to, again, what has been cited as gross systemic efficiencies pervading the entire system. So while it's not an express policy, it's still conduct by the Secretary common to all of petitioners' cases that is the cause of the severe delays throughout the system. Your Honors, if you have no more questions, if I may close, again, by summarizing the three main points for petitioners today, that these delays are egregious and unreasonable and rise to the level of extraordinary circumstances, that a Rule 23 class action procedure is efficient and manageable and fair and provides unparalleled access to justice for veterans and makes things easier for this court. And finally, the present proposed class does satisfy both the 23A criteria for a class action as well as the 23B2 injunctive class action criteria. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. I appreciate the questions related to commonality, Walmart, efficiency, pragmatic solutions, and whether Harrison has been overruled. I would start with the question that this court asked us to focus on in its February 22 order, which is the general framework for aggregate procedures. The encouraging development from the plethora of briefing that you have received is that there is an emerging consensus for this court as to how to proceed for class action procedures. The Secretary has given a number of statements in its briefing that are actually quite consistent with what petitioners and amici are sponsoring. So here are the points of agreement. The four requirements of Rule 23A would be appropriate for a petitioner to need to satisfy. Second, a Rule 23B2 type class is the correct type of class for this court to focus on given its limited jurisdiction. Point three, counsel selection can be administered through the Rule 23G procedures. And point four, there can be fact-finding on class certification issues through the court's fact-finding powers under the All Writs Act. The Secretary concedes that, and we are not asking for something so dramatically different that would turn you into a federal district court. What we posit is that for this first segment on the Monk remand, you actually have a wonderful continuity of counsel coming together as advocates and saying class action mechanisms can be appropriate. We appreciate it's in the nature of an extraordinary writ when it's a petition for mandamus. That is the high burden to which we must be held when trying to satisfy our ultimate request for liability and remedy. But at this point, we envision that you are proceeding, I think, from your court orders in three segments. The first is, let's discuss an appropriate framework for this court. It's going to be different from the Federal Court of Claims, which is only overseeing monetary damages, and you can see they manuscripted Rule 23 for their court to be only Rule 23B3 classes. That makes sense for them. Wouldn't make sense for us. This is a Rule 23B2 type of court because of the injunctive relief. But the second segment, after this court articulates an appropriate framework for us to satisfy, in this case, because you likely don't want to be determining what is the end-all and be-all class action mechanism for all future cases, you would articulate the standard for us to satisfy, and we can then submit briefs tailored to your credentials here, or you might decide you have enough. There's quite a bit of information. You have really what we think are the two critical pieces of information for certification under the aggregated standard that we're seeing the consensus on. What you have is the Secretary's statistics regarding processing, and I promise I will come to the commonality there. And you have the Secretary's submission of the full fact records for each of our petitioners. We would submit that's all the documentation you need for you to determine that this is a class worthy of aggregate treatment and that these petitioners are adequate representatives, and one caveat, that this council is appropriate to represent this case, this class. Now, I know you care deeply about commonality and the intersection with Walmart. Let me turn directly to that, if I may. On commonality, we absolutely understand that it is our job, in light of the Supreme Court guidance, to have a common question and a common answer, and that the court may, in fact, be looking for dissimilarities. And while it is true, Judge Sherlin, that many of these petitioners have different phases that they are at, the similar experience they are receiving is that, on average, they wait a year and 4 months to receive their statement of case. They then have, roughly, on average, 38 days where they put in their notice of appeal. And then they wait, unfortunately, 33 months to have a certificate and a transfer to the board.
Do you agree with what I said before, that in order to establish commonality here, it has to be that there is either a statutory or a constitutional time beyond which a case can no longer be pending, that has to be part of this analysis?
Yes, Judge Allen, and here's how I think it can work out in practice. It's no doubt true, as Judge Bartley raised, that some petitioners are asking for additional assistance. Some petitioners, as the Secretary raised, may not want a fast adjudication within 12 months. But what we are saying is that there are segments for which the Secretary is responsible, and there can be segments for which the individual veteran is responsible. We take on the responsibility for the individual asking for more assistance or other requests for delay. But it's the segments for which the Secretary is unilaterally responsible that have the limit that you are pointing to, Judge Allen. It cannot be that 4 years is an acceptable time frame under the Constitution and under the statutes for issuing a statement of case, which is about 5 to 8 pages, most of which is boilerplate, or issuing the certificate and doing the physical transfer to the board. 4 years is just simply too long for the processing. Now, any of you might say, but counselors, how are you going to discern between those petitioners who want the constitutionally mandated deadline and those who want more assistance or just some more time to process? What I would say is that it's not the right time to handle it at opt-in or opt-out. Why? Individuals might not know what they want at that point in time. What I would posit is that this court does have the responsibility and the discretion to issue a mandatory timeline, and that would be the remedy. After that point, let's call it the Monk Rule, is 12 months from NOD to board decision.
But I sort of want to follow up on what Judge Allen was talking about sort of dividing out what might be, is it statutorily appropriate delay versus you know, unreasonable action. I mean, it seems like you're advocating sort of a strict liability approach. I mean, it doesn't, good reason, bad reason, no reason, it you know, 2 years or 13 months is too long. I don't see how we can, in effect, affect a remedy unless there's actual behavior that we're specifically targeting. I mean, we can't say, be faster, right? I mean, if the reasons are legitimate, it's useless. It won't help anyone.
So, Judge Took, you raise exactly the point that makes us different from Walmart. Is it strict liability there, whereas in Walmart there was a scienter requirement,
right?
Under Title VII, it's disparate impact or disparate treatment, but both of them have some animus. And here, I would actually say that is far more akin to strict liability, and that's what the DL...
Let me ask you, if someone got a petition within 13 months, mm-hmm. is that a due process violation? Because, you know, if we're going to go bright line and strict liability, it would have to be a due process violation for us to give you, push it back a month. You know, 11 months and 355 days is not,
right.
And then one day over is.
Right. I appreciate it's a good question at the margins. Is 11 months and 29 days within the Constitution, and 4 days later you're all of a sudden in a constitutional violation? That seems a bit hard, but what I would say is that it is the province of this court to say, well, we recommend 12 months from NOD to board decision. You might say, looking at ERSPEMA, it's really 1 to 2 years. That's your discretion, and that's at the writ stage, and we appreciate. We're advocates, so we're asking for what we think is a constitutionally appropriate. But the Secretary is part and parcel of this overall remedy that we're seeking, and we would wish to act cooperatively and come up with a remedial plan together if you agreed with us on the constitutional and statutory violations.
And you, let me just, to, on that point, so as an experienced class action litigator, you can satisfy commonality, can't you, even if the answer that drives the litigation under 23A2 is actually adverse to you, right? So in other words, there's a distinction between a common question or common answer and whether one wins or loses.
You're so right. And Justice Ginsburg said that in Amgen when she said materiality does not have to be proved successfully at the class cert stage in the securities class actions, which is the place where I practice and know this. But what she said, it's a common question that has a common answer. They may fail in unison. We may fail in unison. I don't want that to be the case. But what you're being asked is, can you decide this question of unconscionable delay as a group? And I would posit that you're much better off adjudicating this as a group. And now we've heard twice from the Federal Circuit, they're sort of looking to guide us to adjudicate this question of delay as a group. And I know, Chief Judge Davis, from your concurring opinion in Rosinski, that the delay weighs on you and Judge Greenberg. Obviously, you've issued a call to action about the delay.
A call? This is a shriek. Alone.
It was effective.
But let me ask you a question. In all seriousness, we have a certain class of human being here identified by Congress as a favored class, veterans.
Yes.
We've got a very healthy-looking Mr. Monk in the courtroom, but the statute requires that he be alive at the time of the decision. What? My qu- question is, what is the order you want us to put forward, if we could do it today, that would satisfy you on behalf of the class?
Your Honor, the order would be the writ that the Secretary issue board decisions, grant, deny, remand, within 12 months of the NOD being timely filed. That is our request. We think that the 16 and a half months for the SOC to be issued and the nearly 3 years for transfer to the board is unconscionable. Now, we understand that in the Secretary's additional brief in response to our amended petition, they raised many pragmatic concerns that Judge Peach is referring to. How can you just tell the Secretary, thou shalt adjudicate within 1 year tens of thousands of petitions that have been outstanding?
Why can't we?
I agree with you. That's not a surprise.
By the way, just a dawn analogy just occurred to me. In the BMW case, with regard to exemplary damages, the Supreme Court said, you know, we don't know how much is too much, but this is too much. $5 million or $15 million in punitive damages for a bad paint job on a BMW, it's just too much. Isn't that what you're asking for? 5 years is too much.
Yes.
We don't know what's perfect, but a year sounds more like it than 5 or 6 years.
That's right. And if a petitioner doesn't like our 1 year, sorry, if a veteran doesn't like our 1 year, we would say, as the Secretary did on page 85 of their brief, let them waive it. Let them waive the benefit of the Monk Rule because they want a slower track in order to have more assistance or more review. Chief Judge.
Ms. Norman, I'm a kind of a practical person. I like to talk about practicalities. So let's say, for example, that the court agrees and imposes a 2-year requirement on the Secretary. At what point is the Secretary strictly responsible for getting the SOC out or a board decision? Actually, I guess that's really what you're asking for.
Right.
Within that period, and what is the impact if the petitioner or the veteran is responsible for some of that, some delay within that period, such that it can't happen within 2 years? The waiver, I believe, touches on that.
So yes.
Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure, I'd be happy to. If this court issued a remedy, and let's imagine it's 18 months, and the Secretary, I think, would be directed to, A, submit a remedial plan as to its pathway forward to adjudicate the multiple tens of thousands of petitioners who have been waiting for more than 1 year. I think it's fair to say, based on the direction you're taking, that the Secretary could sift through those, if it so chose, and said, there are some where we take the onus, it shouldn't take us 3 years to transfer a case, we'll start transferring those with greater dispatch, we'll employ better technology, we'll get McKinsey in here, we'll do it. Then there's perhaps a subset where they say, look, it's really the veteran who wants more time here. And this is not meant to be a draconian, we know more than the Secretary does. The Secretary is living and breathing this every day. So we think that the remedial plan can have contours so that ultimately this court would be satisfied that its writ is being implemented. I hope
even
ultimately,
if it goes a little beyond the time period that we've directed for.
Right. This court would work in a cooperative oversight fashion by asking the Secretary to submit the remedial plan, and then thereafter you would have regular check-ins, for example.
I have a question about the back end. Let's say we were to certify a class and we were to grant whatever deadline it is appropriate, and 3 years from now there's a veteran whose case exceeds that set parameter. How would that work? Would a veteran come to Yale and they would stay on as class counsel and would assert enforcement? Would the veteran have a right to do that themselves? Would they seek their own lawyer to do that or VSO?
So our view, Your Honor, it's a great question in terms of the practical implementation, is that if the writ were issued and a certain timeline was imposed by this court on the secretary, and an individual found that he was not being processed in the timely fashion, he could take any of the following courses. He could write to the secretary himself and say, I believe you're in violation of the Monk Rule. He could contact the Yale Legal Services Clinic. He could work through his normal veterans representative organization. What I also anticipate in your question is that you might have misgivings about being in a perpetual state of oversight for the agency. I fully accept that. We all do. Many remedial plans are put into place for 1 to 3 years with the input of the agency being overseen. Most, for example, civil rights cases, police departments are able to get themselves turned around and in compliance with the court order within 2 years. I don't think anyone wants to see you here in, you know, the year 2022 overseeing whether it's been 11 months and 29 days or 12 months and 14 days.
You won't be saying me because I'll be gone. And I'd like to ask a question based on your experience that I asked your co-counsel. Again, this court has precedential decision authority.
Yes.
In your practice, you don't seek a class action in every single case, I'm assuming.
No.
What's the distinguishing factor that we should use?
It's a great question because it's somewhat foretelling the future. I would say that preliminarily, you would want to take this as the Federal Court of Claims did on a case-by-case basis. Look at the contours of that particular case. This one we think is well-suited for class aggregation treatment because it is a bit of a strict liability, no mens rea, type of violation we're claiming. However, you may see something coming down the road where it turns on recognition of expert evidence regarding medical causation, where you say, we're not comfortable treating this as a B2 class. We don't see the commonality. We'd rather deal with it on a precedential basis because the contours of the claim are making you believe it's far more suited to individual adjudication, or you just don't necessarily want these experts in this particular petition to be the experts across the board for the thousands of other similarly situated individuals. And there you might need to have an opt-in because you don't want everyone to be bound by the medical experts that happen to be chosen by this particular class counsel and class representative. My point is, I think that as you venture into these waters, you can adopt a class action protocol for this particular case that you modify for the next one or for the third, and similarly that you say, this is just not an appropriate case, your next individual petition, for class treatment. You might even want to experiment with omnibus for a medical causation bellwether trial, but that's part of the tools in your toolkit. It sounds like you're not there yet, but for this particular one, we have the Federal Circuit and eBags actually urging us, saying, we think class action treatment is the best method, which was a pretty strong statement for them to issue. I see that my time is gone, Your Honor.
Could you add 2 minutes, please?
Thank you. If I
five, I have more questions.
Okay. I apologize. If I may just, Judge Meredith, I'd really like to return to your question about is Harrison overturned, and my able colleague, Ms. McCarthy, said she thought it was overturned as to the authority point. On behalf of our entire group, we would say we think Harrison is overturned as to manageability as well and the alternative methods of precedential opinions. However, that's not to say that manageability can't be taken into your calculus when certifying class, or that the necessity, I know that the Secretary is going to advocate a rule of necessity be grafted onto the Rule 23A requirements. Personally, we don't see the need for that because if you're certifying a class, you're making a determination it's appropriate in these circumstances. Therefore, we don't think adding a rule of necessity is required.
Can I ask you what language in the Federal Circuit's Monk decision you think overturned the manageability and precedential opinion pieces of Harrison?
So I understand where you're going, Your Honor, because when you look at what I have is page 14 of the Monk Federal Circuit decision, they refer to the Veterans Court relies on Harrison and it's talking about no authority, and then they say we disagree that the veteran court's authority is so limited, and then refers to 7261, which is the your court's ability to compel action. From our perspective, the Federal Circuit could not be saying that class actions can help the Veterans Court with efficiency, consistency, fairness, and access to justice if they didn't think that on remand you have the power and authority to adopt class actions. They literally say in their conclusion that they reverse and remand for the Veterans Court to determine whether a class action or other method of aggregation would be appropriate here. I think they are, maybe it's sub silentio, but I think they are taking the tack that Harrison is not handcuffs on you, even if, as the Secretary says, there are prongs 2 and 3.
If I could, I have one other question about the Federal Circuit. The Secretary has argued that they believe a class certification decision by this court may not be reviewable by the Federal Circuit because it would involve either fact-finding or application of fact to law. Do you agree with that assessment? Is that something that we should take into account in determining whether to proceed with a class action?
We saw that from the Secretary. We don't necessarily take the same view. We think that the Federal Circuit ultimately would have authority to review the class certification decision as part of the final, ultimate decision. What is interesting, I think, is whether you would have, if you adopted rules at some point in the future, a Rule 23F provision, which allows, you know, in the circuit courts, an interlocutory review of class certification in the midst of the case. That, I think, is a closer question, whether there could be interlocutory jurisdiction at the Federal Circuit. But from our perspective, ultimately, at the end of the class certification, liability, and writ stage, there's going to be a final judgment which would be fully reviewable by the Federal Circuit, in our opinion.
And wouldn't that be supported as well by the fact that the Federal Circuit has a lot more authority when there are constitutional questions in play? And I would think that even in a non-constitutional merits case, I mean, a component of class certification is in fact constitutional because you're binding non-parties.
We agree, Judge Allen.
I'm having some, to be honest, grave misgivings about a lot of this. And I think part of my difficulty is I quite frankly don't understand why you chose to frame the class so broadly. When this is just my personal preference, that it would have been drawn a little more narrowly to include veterans who, for whom all development has been completed and they're just waiting in line. Because the way you're doing it, you're talking about, well, if a veteran is faced with having the quicker procedure within 1 year, you know, board decision within 1 year, or further development, they can waive the further development. So the veteran will have to make a decision, and most veterans don't know, you know, what's what as mm-hmm. far as which would be preferable for them. And quite frankly, I think in probably a lot of cases, probably the majority, further development would be preferable.
Let me speak directly to your misgivings and reservations. I think this can
before
be taken.
Before you do, counsel?
Yes.
I'm sorry. 5 minutes, please.
Oh, I apologize.
Go ahead.
I think the way we would like to get you comfortable is to think of this in segments, each of which is subject to modification. So really at this stage, this first segment would really be, can there be a class action in the Monk proceeding? And what would be the criteria that need to be certified? On that, I think there's remarkable consensus. You're going to phase two, which is, what is the nature of this class, and is bothering me that it is so expansive because some of it would not be secretarial delay, it would be the individual veteran delay. I appreciate your pragmatic approach to that. I do. And one thing that we could do is modify, when you get to that class certification stage of actually certifying, you could redefine the class. You all could say, look, counselors, that's too broad. Let's bring it down to just those who are waiting in line.
I understand we can modify, but my question is, you apparently chose not to go that way and to be broader. And the broader characterization of the class requires that the veteran make a lot of very important decisions about development. And some of you were talking about the, you know, VA delay versus the veteran himself or herself creating the delay. I think a lot of the delay, maybe not to the extent that it occurs, but to the extent that it occurs at all, is legitimate delay because VA is developing.
And, Your Honor, from our perspective, if the way we propose to handle this, and you might not like this, is to establish the constitutional minimum, right, the deadline within which the VA needs to do the processing. That's the certification and the writ. And then you're right. Our proposal is if an individual veteran doesn't want that constitutional deadline, he or she can waive the relief that this court would have ordered. And we think that it's better to have the rule established and the veteran waive it than to ask people to opt in or out, because at that point we think they'd have even less capacity to make an informed decision. From our perspective, we are, in fact, looking for the ultimate remedy, that 4 years for processing. And what I haven't talked about is the extra 9.5 months it takes for the board to actually render its decision. Now, that in and of itself doesn't seem like an unconscionable time, right? The Second Circuit is on a similar schedule. But when you put it after 4 years' worth of delay, then it's a 5-year or even a 6-year gap for the veterans looking for their disability benefit.
Are you seeking any discovery?
Your Honor, we are not. We are not. We think that you can make the class certification decision here based on the papers. This is also the interesting situation where the Secretary has full records on all of our petitioners. Normally, when we're defending against class actions, we, the defendants, want class discovery because we want to sit down and depose the class representatives and really test their typicality and their adequacy. Here, we don't think that that's required because we can do it on the papers.
Counsel, so this is sort of a perspective question, kind of goes beyond this case, but obviously we don't have Rule 12. There's no 12b-6. There's no Rule 56. So prospectively, how would we account for, you know, judging whether a claim is frivolous just up front or something like that? Or do you think it's just right through the certification stage and see if it's a live question and determine it there?
That's a really great question. You do have the capacity to graft your own rules. We're talking obviously about Rule 23, but often that does come after 12b-6 is done. But it does always come before a Rule 56 summary judgment. So, and the federal rules have suggest that class certification is far better done near the start of the case. You may have petitions for extraordinary relief or mandamus relief that you say are just completely off base. There's no there in terms of the constitutional or statutory violation. And I would think that the Secretary could come forward and make at the outset a motion to dismiss on the face of the petition so that this court need not be troubled, whether it's a one-judge decision or a three-judge panel, when then going through a class certification evaluation. I realize I've gone far beyond my time. I so appreciate the extra.
Sure.
Could
you add 2 minutes, please?
Earlier, and I may have misunderstood, but your petition asks for class action for those individuals who have filed a disagreement and have not gotten a decision within 1 year. But there was some discussion about, I think in response to Judge Greenberg's opinion of request, why did you choose 1 year?
Yes.
And that led me to believe, I think somebody, where was it, 18 month something?
Yes.
That leads me to believe that perhaps you were thinking the court might do something more than 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 18 months. Is there some flexibility that you see?
So in Erskineer, the court stated that 3 years is unconstitutionally too long. It was a 3-year segment within an overall 10-year segment, and both were too long. That was the widow case. Here, we think 1 year is appropriate, but what the court said in Erskineer is several months is okay, perhaps 1 to 2 years. We don't like the 2 years. So we took off 2 years. We understand 1 year is something that this court might have trouble announcing when we get to the writ remedy stage. And at that point, I fully expect that the secretary would come in when we're at that writ remedy stage and say, 12 months is impossible. We really need 18 months. And at that point, we'd talk about both the remedial plan for the existing backlog and what an appropriate plan is going forward.
Okay. Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Nooner, I'm sorry, Ms. Hogan, before you begin, you have an additional 19 minutes should you need to use it.
Okay, wonderful, thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, this Court should decline to certify the class proposed by petitioners and dismiss the petition for two reasons. First, because they failed to satisfy the criteria for class certification, and second, because the issues raised are not appropriate for judicial resolution as framed by petitioners. Your Honors, the Secretary recognizes that there are individual veterans who are waiting too long for an adjudication of their appeals in the legacy appeals system. The Secretary also recognizes there are circumstances and cases where adjudication through a class action tool may provide relief to a large number of people at one time. However, this Court is not the appropriate venue in which to consider or implement broad programmatic changes to the legacy appeal system, and based on the claims as phrased by petitioners in this case, class action is not the appropriate litigation tool to adjudicate the allegedly unreasonable or unconstitutional delays they have identified.
What do we do with the statement from the Federal Circuit in eBanks? I mean, I understand it's dicta, but it's sort of like when my wife suggests to me that I do something that is far more than dicta, and I've learned after a quarter of a century. So what do we do with that?
Well, Your Honor, the Secretary recognizes, while we stated that we do not think a class action tool is necessary in this court, we do recognize there may be circumstances where the court chooses to use a class action tool, and that there may be cases where the way that the class is framed would allow for commonality to adjudicate delays, or would allow for typicality, would allow for the appropriate B2 type of relief to be issued. This case, however, the way it is phrased by petitioners here is not that case.
But and I know you're going to go into that, but here's what I'm following up with. This is the question I promised I was going to ask you, is if, in fact, it were the rule that the cause of delay is critical as to whether there could be relief, okay, if that were the law, then the statement of the Federal Circuit in eBanks makes no sense, because having a class action as the way to adjudicate a delay claim wouldn't make any sense, because the individual reasons for delay would undermine commonality or remedy under 23b2, right? So isn't that suggesting that, at least in the Federal Circuit's eye, perhaps, there is a point in time where delay is just simply too long, regardless of getting into the reasons for it? That's what I'm thinking about.
Your Honor, we read eBanks slightly differently, because in that case it is just the period of you've asked for a hearing and it was when that hearing was going to be held. And so that is a period of waiting where the individual causes or the application of the duty to assist may not be relevant. So it seems to be a different type of class and a different type of situation and a different type of analysis than the one here. Here we have a situation where it's just the statement of I filed a notice of disagreement and I'm waiting for a decision at this time, as opposed to where the duty to assist and the legacy appeal system and all of the requirements for the Secretary to act all come into play, as opposed to in eBanks where it was just that period of waiting that was being discussed by the court. So it seems like there may be some flexibility there. We would still have the concern as to Rule 23b2, 23b2, and whether the type of relief that was being ordered would at that point become a problem under Heckler or would require more than one individual type of injunction. But there seems to be a distinguishment between a class that is defined based on a set period of like ready to rate or waiting for a decision when everything else is done, as opposed to just the passage of time unrestricted by anything except the beginning and the end of the system, since the system that was designed by Congress requires multiple steps by the Secretary as well as multiple stages of participation by the veteran, and largely the amount of time and the number of decisions that are issued in that pendency are reliant both on the Secretary's actions and the veteran's actions. If there's an allegation of worsening, that restarts the time clock. If there is additional evidence submitted that raises new arguments, that resets the time clock. And so looking at just the time frame as to the whole system is where our problem is and where we see a distinction between the class that was framed here and the dicta that the Federal Circuit discussed in the Ebanks case.
So, Ms. Hogan, is that the key to your position? And this touches on a question that Judge Bartley raised regarding how broadly defined this class was. If this class were more narrowly defined, are you suggesting that there may be an appropriate certification?
There may be, Your Honor. It would, again, depend on the class that was defined. And we do think that if there was a more targeted, more narrow class that didn't involve necessarily the application of the duty to assist or factors that would trigger additional development, additional decisions, additional stages, but if we were just looking at that ready-to-rate period, that it may be different. We would still, at that point, have to look at whether there was numerosity pled, whether there was typicality shown, adequacy of representation, whether B2 would be the appropriate form of relief, and all of those factors, since they do all need to be present for the certification decision. But that is one of our main concerns, and I think it came through a bit in our pleading that we did not realize that petitioners were asking for a board decision within 1 year. It's something that we actually struggled with quite a lot, was defining what class they were looking for and what stages of the process they were looking for. And where we have a situation like here where it is a broader, more programmatic attack, that is something that traditionally is deemed more appropriate for the legislative branches, who recently acted on this very issue when they passed the Appeals Modernization Act.
It seems they're actually asking potentially for a statement of the case and a board decision if somebody had filed an NOD and hadn't yet received an SOC.
Yes, Your Honor, and there's also the intervening stage of the substantive appeal that must be filed as well, since even if the Secretary issues an SOC, we can't issue a board decision until a substantive appeal has been filed. So there's multiple stages that have all been lumped into this one class, and it causes a lot of problems on the commonality front from our point of view.
Well, to follow up on the Chief's question about whether you, how you would feel about a class that was composed of those who, for whom development has been completed,
yes,
and who are merely waiting in line for adjudication, is it possible for the Secretary, I'm talking about like databases now, is it possible for the Secretary to identify the members of such a class who, for whom development has been completed and who are waiting in line for an adjudication?
To a certain extent, Your Honor. Obviously, the problem that we might incur is that if an individual veteran submits additional evidence at some point or submits a statement that triggers a new duty to assist.
But barring a submission or a request from a veteran.
I believe the answer to that is yes, Your Honor. We do have situations where they are marked as ready to wait, where that may happen.
If I could follow, sorry.
Oh, I was just, do you know how many are in that group?
I do not, Your Honor.
Okay.
I can find out for you if you would like, but I don't know at the moment.
Could you talk a little bit about under what circumstances do you think it would be appropriate for the court to either narrow the class or certify subclasses rather than outright denying certification?
Yes, Your Honor. So from the Secretary's point of view, since this is an appellate court, and since the court has made clear historically that it expects the parties to bring their arguments to the court and present them as they intend for them to be, we think that the court's role in narrowing or redefining or creating their own class or creating subclasses where they weren't asked for by the parties should also be narrow. This isn't a federal district court. This isn't a trial court where things are much more fluid. This is an appellate body, and parties are traditionally held to their pleadings. So we think that the type of amendability and the type of expectations that the court places on individuals seeking to represent a class as a whole should be rather strictly construed, and it should be if the parties if the party seeking certification identified classes or subclasses as appropriate or defined the class in such a way that was more narrow, that should be the circumstance where the court adopts that.
And you think that's appropriate even though this is our initial go at perhaps doing a class action to hold someone to those stringent requirements?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the petitioners had the opportunity to reform their class. They elected to do so in a broader manner and to increase the number of stages involved and increase the number of veterans involved. So since they already have been given the opportunity to amend their class and could have changed it in any way they saw fit, it seems inappropriate at this point, or not necessarily inappropriate, but maybe that we should now hold them to their second class that they proposed and the second class that they defined. And there are litigation strategies in how groups just choose to bring their case, and that is the strategy that they chose. The Secretary didn't play a role in that, and the Court didn't play a role in that, and I think that we should hold them to their pleadings.
But, you know, we often do this ourselves as judges. We use the word pleadings. In the pure civil procedure sense, there are no pleadings ever filed in this court, right?
Yes, because, Your Honor.
Right. No. No, I'm not criticizing you. I'm saying that that's one of the struggles I think that we're all having.
Yes.
Which is, you know, we use these terms, but in fact, in a district court, a pleading would be a complaint, which could include the class allegations, and then there are amendment ways.
Right.
And so, from an efficiency standpoint, if we just said, well, you know, you didn't frame it quite well enough, if you had done X, Y, and Z, it might have done, but we're going to hold you strictly to it. I'm not suggesting necessarily that this is what would happen, but I would suspect the next day there'd be another writ, right, because they could file another one with a narrower class. So wouldn't it make, if we're going to go down that road, wouldn't it make some sense to say, let's see if we can get a class here? If the court said, well, had you said A, B, and C, that might have been different. I mean, wouldn't it just make sense to do it in this context as opposed to getting rid of this and then having a new petition?
It may to a certain extent, Your Honor, but then it does bring us back to the manageability and the efficiency front of considering a class action in the first instance in this court. If we are constantly relitigating what the class should be and the court constantly is redefining what class they think would be appropriate or what steps need to be taken for certification to be possible, we come back to the same problem of if we could have just adjudicated this in a precedential decision in the first instance rather than having multiple stages and months, potentially years, of litigation over what the class should be, what's an acceptable class, then we're losing any of the efficiencies that class actions are supposedly supposed to bring to the court. So while there is some room for flexibility, and obviously that's up to the court's discretion, what flexibility they want to have, there is the eventual trade-off between multiple rounds of litigation over who petitioners choose to define as their class and what relief they're seeking, and then also the constant need for the Secretary to respond and to redefine and to attempt to answer yet another class.
If we were to modify the class, that's not something that the Secretary could appeal, right? That is within the court's discretion.
It's unclear to me, to be candid, Your Honor, as we don't have a framework at this point, whether should the court choose to modify that class, whether the Secretary would have an opportunity to respond to it. I think that would be up to what the court decided the parties' roles would be in that decision. We would obviously like the opportunity to respond if the court were to choose to redefine the class, but I think that would ultimately be up to the system that the court decides to implement.
Okay, let me change tack a little bit here. If the court were to certify a class and agree that there were systemic delays that were unreasonable or unconstitutional or unlawful, what would be a realistic time frame for issuing a post-NOD, let's say, board decision? But if you could give me your view on a post-NOD SOC.
Okay. Currently, our averages for the post-NOD SOC are around 420 days, I believe. It goes up and down a little bit, but that is the current average. That is what the Secretary is doing. The Secretary has recently requested in the 2019 budget an additional 605 appeals adjudicators in the hopes of accelerating that. But under the current legacy appeals system, because of the way the system is structured and because how much development might be necessary, it's a very flexible number is the problem that we have.
Okay, right. But you were telling me what it is.
Currently,
now,
yes.
I'm saying if we were to certify the class and move along with it, and we were, because it seems to me as though the petitioners basically said, well, we plucked 1 year out of thin air. What would be reasonable, in your view, to reach both an NOC and or a board decision, assuming the SOC, you know, the claim continued to be denied?
Your Honor, I do not have a answer on that. I am happy to get back to you. We obviously were under the impression that we were talking about the SOC as opposed to the final board decision.
Oh, okay. Give me the SOC. So you were telling me what it is now, that you want to get it done quicker, but
yes.
If we were going to, certify class and move on with this, what time frame do you think we should look at for issuance of an SOC, if indeed we were to go that way?
Well, Your Honor, I was told by the Appeals Management Office that 12 months for every single decision that is currently pending is impossible. We are not capable of doing that and satisfying the duty to assist.
You mean from the time of an NOD to an SOC?
From today, we would not be able to adjudicate any pending NODs, all of them that exist within 12 months. It's not possible. Any NOD that has been existing for more than 12 months, for us to do that within 12 months would not be possible.
But I just
want to be clear. You're talking about issuance of either a rating decision granting based on the NOD or an SOC.
Yes.
Okay.
What if hypothetically, and this is a true question, what if hypothetically we decided that period of time, that it was unconstitutional to not have this decision done on a property interest within that period of time? Just assume that.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do with a government official's response that says, I just can't do it?
Well, Your Honor, the D.C. Circuit actually recently addressed that in AHA v. Price, and they found that in that situation, if the government agency has clearly stated it is not possible, that is the type of writ that should not be issued. That is an instance where the court should exercise its discretion and decline to issue a writ that is affirmatively impossible for the secretary to comply with.
So in that case, there was a constitutional violation found?
No, Your Honor, that was a unreasonable delay analysis.
Right, so let's go back. Let's just assume that the court can, and I'm not saying that this is so, right? But let's just assume that the court determined that period of time, 12 months, was in violation of the United States Constitution. Would it be okay for the court to do nothing because the government responds, we can't do it, right, because of the competing resources we have?
I do understand the concern, Your Honor, and it would be a very difficult assessment to make. The fact is that the secretary couldn't comply with it, so I guess the court in that situation would have to consider contempt issues, but that would also be a problem in that the secretary would be limited by the resources and the restrictions that are on him, so therefore we would again have the problem where the contempt standard wasn't met. The 12-month standard was just part of why the Supreme Court in the Heckler decision, which I understand is not a constitutional case, but talked about the imposition of mandatory deadlines on government agencies where Congress has recognized there are factors such as development or individualized factors in cases that play into that period of time that would be an issue. The Secretary obviously does have limited resources. There are a limited number of employees the Secretary has that handle VBA cases, that is based on statutory or congressional allotments. The Secretary has obviously prioritized the primary claims with the largest number of people because those are the largest number of claims that we face, approximately 1.4 million, versus the approximately 10% that are appeals, and approximately 10% of the Secretary's workforce handle appeals in the VBA status. We are asking for more employees. We are making strides to do this. We worked with Congress, we worked with VSOs, we worked with non-VSOs to pass the Appeals Modernization Act because we recognize the issue that is the legacy appeal system, the fact that they are very long time periods. The Secretary has also offered the option of opting into the RAMP program, which is providing faster decisions at the VBA stage through either the supplemental claim line or the higher level review line for legacy appellants who choose to opt into that system. So we are making strides, we are making efforts, and hopefully that's something that the court would take into consideration if it had decided 12 months is the deadline, and regardless of what the legacy appeal system says and regardless of what the Secretary's resources are, 12 months is that, and hopefully that's something the court would be willing to consider.
Well, sure. Surely we have the power to order you, if we were to certify a class that the appellant wants, we have the power to order you to do it, right? Order the Secretary to comply with the order.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then you have a remedy. Take an appeal, go to Congress, say we need more money to hire even more than the 350,000 people that are already in the VA to deal with these issues. Do you agree with that?
The Secretary would make every effort to comply.
Well, let me ask you this. We're now confronted with an issue of whether to certify a class. Isn't that the only way we can be sure as a court that the world will know what we have ordered the Secretary to do, as opposed to dealing with it on an individual case-by-case basis?
No, Your Honor.
Well, are you familiar with the case of Staub?
I am, Your Honor.
That's right. And this court ordered, now almost 2 years ago, that the Secretary was in violation of a statute that involved hundreds of thousands of veterans. What did the Secretary do? Secretary appealed, then went to Congress and said, I thought it over, I'm withdrawing my appeal. And then what did the Secretary do? Put out a notice of rulemaking in a situation where it was clearly a matter of statutory construction. All they had to do was pay it. What's going to happen here if we adopt your position?
Well, the Secretary would disagree with that assessment of...
Well, have they been paid? Has Staub been paid?
That I am not sure of, Your Honor. However, we have implemented interim final rules.
Why do you need any rules at all?
Because the court's decision, Your Honor, was not self-executing, and the Secretary has been making every effort to comply. We started at the time that we appealed the decision and have been working on it since then. The Secretary recognizes that this court's decisions are binding precedent on him and makes every effort to comply with the court's decisions. And in this case, the Secretary, if the court did issue an order saying that the individual veterans here had an unreasonably or unconstitutionally long time period for their decisions, would make every effort to accelerate that. And also, the Secretary has been making repeated steps to accelerate the legacy appeal system as it is. There are restrictions on what the Secretary can skip and what steps it can take, or he can take, because of the design of the legacy appeal system, which does...
Well, what's wrong with just trying it? We order you to dispose of these cases within a year, this class of case within a year. You do your best. We're assuming everybody's acting in good faith. If the Secretary is acting in good faith, we're assuming that. So you do your best. Mr. Monk gets his decision, as do every member of the class, within a year. Or you come back to this court or to the standing master acting for this court and say, we just can't. And here's the proof. It's not just an argument. We've tried. We've hired the 600 extra people. They're working 40 or 50 hours a week or 35 hours a week, and they can't get it done. Surely you can trust this court to be rational and reasonable and entertain those arguments?
Well, Your Honor, the Secretary has been trying. The Secretary has been working incredibly hard.
Well, why don't you just take the application from the appellant and say, we'll try it for the year that they've requested, and then come back and say, we just tried, we can't do it. It's unreasonable. But you're taking the position now without anything else saying the Secretary can't do it.
No, I'm taking the position now with the Secretary having worked very hard for the past several years with additional resources, with additional streamlining, with organizing under the Appeals Management Office, all of these steps with the goal of adjudicating claims faster. The Secretary, as you mentioned, is acting in good faith and is trying to adjudicate these claims faster. But there are factors that go into that. There is a requirement that the secretary ensure the duty to assist is satisfied. There is a requirement that the secretary provide notice and an opportunity to the veteran to reply. There is a requirement that if the secretary does not receive records, he asks for them again and again as many times as necessary, and that the secretary reads every record that comes in, looks at the evidence that's in it, and makes every effort to find any claims that may be in there, any issues that may be identified, any additional evidence that must be requested, and those things take time. The length of a record that the secretary faces on just to do a single adjudication depends on every single case. Some cases have up to 15,000 pages in them. Some only have 500. And the amount of time that each of those takes is something that is compelled by law. It's compelled by Congress. It's part of the design of the legacy appeal system. It's part of why the Appeals Modernization Act was passed, so that there is going to now be a frame or a line where there is a supplemental claim where you can add new evidence. There is going to be a line where there is a closed record appeal. But then we can measure things and make it so that the decision is being based on the same information.
We've been told twice now within 6 months by the Federal Circuit, you better get with the program on class actions. So we're here to hear the arguments on that. We make a decision, assuming we make a decision that a class certification is appropriate here, and let's assume it's a year or 18 months or whatever the court decides. Within that period of time, you'll do your level best to comply. They'll be there. It's an adversary system. You'll be there. You'll be back to the court saying it's impossible. We've tried to do it all within a year or 18 months or whatever it is. Or you'll go to Congress, and Congress will make a decision. A year is just too long, is not long enough. Why aren't these remedies always available to you? You do remember a court once said, with all deliberate speed, and then for the next 50 years, year in and year out, had to decide and be more insistent, ever more insistent.
Yes, Your Honor.
As to what that meant. Here, we're even being more concrete. 1 year is 1 year. Try it.
The Secretary respectfully submits, Your Honor, that first, the Secretary has been trying, and second, the one-year mandatory deadline does not comply with the Heckler v. Day standards set forth by the Supreme Court, and third, that a one-year mandatory deadline would not be in compliance with Rule 23b-2 because, as petitioners noted, there would be situations where there would need to be exceptions, and under the Walmart v. Dukes decision, in order for a class to be certified under B2, it has to be a final injunction that applies to all or none of the class members and allows for final resolution of the case. If the court were to impose a mandatory deadline, as you're suggesting, regardless of Heckler v. Day, then we would have a situation where the secretary would either have a case before it that is still in the process of being developed, or a case where a veteran asked for more time or asked to submit additional information, and the secretary would either have to deny that claim because 12 months are up and we need to deny it, even though that would be a violation of our lawful duties.
How about granting it?
The secretary is not allowed to grant claims unless they are proven by the evidence of record. That is part of the statutory obligation for the secretary to comply with the system designed by Congress.
Isn't this a little bit of a red herring, just this idea of not applying to everybody? Because if it were a year deadline and it were going to be developed yet, couldn't you just say to the veteran, we're going to have to deny the claim because it's not fully developed, because we have to decide within a year or whatever time? If you'd like us to continue to develop it, we'll do that. You just have to affirmatively waive your right. I mean, wouldn't that be the way to solve it?
That may be, Your Honor. However, since it is a final injunctive order that applies to all or to none, then we would get in the situation of that veteran or the secretary having to apply to the court to ask for either a waiver or a tolling of the mandatory deadline that the court sets. So then we would get into the situation of the court having to basically adopt an injunction for each veteran at that stage, a different injunction for each individual as opposed to a single injunction that would apply to all. It would involve the parties coming back to the court every single time that there was one of those situations which is not in compliance with what B2 requires under Walmart v. Dukes. It's also not in compliance with a finding of a single final injunctive order. And if we did a flexible deadline of 12 months, we would again be in the same situation as where you were suggesting that we could just extend the time period. We would then again have to get court approval potentially, or the involvement of the court in whether that flexibility is appropriate in this case or whether it's not. And that would cause additional litigation, and it wouldn't be a single final injunctive order that applies to all parties.
I appreciate that in your response of what the average amount of time is to decide or to provide an SOC now, and that the agency doesn't foresee how it could do that work in 12 mm-hmm. months. I have to say I don't totally agree with you, because when the Secretary has chosen to prioritize a class of claims, it has done so, such as with initial claims, it was able to reduce significantly the average day to an initial decision. So I think the Secretary could throw everybody at this now clearly defined or somewhat more clearly defined class, but what impact would that have on other parts of the claim stream?
You know, it would have a very significant impact on other parts of the claim stream at that point. If we're talking about an SOC, then all of the VBA staff would have to be shifted over to the Appeals Management Office to only work those SOCs. And that would be all of the 1.4 million claims the Secretary receives each year for initial claims. These are individuals who haven't had the opportunity to have their claim heard, who haven't had the opportunity to establish entitlement to health care, who haven't received a denial because they haven't had their claim adjudicated. Those individuals would then get shifted behind the individuals who have had their claim denied at one point. If we're talking
about the Secretary sort of create this problem a little bit by front-loading the process and then leaving the appeals to a more limited class of their employees to work on?
Historically, that may have happened, Your Honor, but currently the percentage of the Secretary's VBA employees who are handling appeals are approximately proportionate to the percentage of VBA.
But they're more complex cases.
Some of them are, Your Honor, yes. But there is a trade-off that the Secretary is required to make, and the Secretary receives a lump sum budget from the government or from Congress and then has to make those hard decisions, and that's the Secretary's discretion of what decisions to make. And
how is the appellate workforce going to be impacted by the ramp process that you are now taking more people offline? Where are those people coming from?
Currently, Your Honor, the first batch of ramp cases have been handled by individuals who were based in D.C. at the AMO, formerly the Appeals Management Center, now the appeal.
So
the
people
ARC.
Who worked appeals?
Yes, Your Honor, but not in the regional offices. They have been handling the ramp process, and the individuals who have opted into the ramp process, those invitations began with the oldest legacy appeals, so they are still legacy appellants being worked in. As the percentage of individuals who accept invitations into the ramp process goes up, the Secretary is aiming to train individuals in other regional offices to handle those, because as of February 2019, when the Appeals Modernization Act does go into full effect, those are the individuals who are going to be adjudicating not only the legacy appeals that remain outstanding, but also working under the higher level review to make sure that that is taking place at that time, too. So the Secretary is using his resources, shifting his resources with the goal of accomplishing these things. The Secretary in 2016 increased the amount of appeals resolutions by 16%. Last year we increased it by another 10%. We are making strides and we are working very hard on it. And then to the other question of how we would deal with the cases at the board level, we have requested additional employees at the board. It is more difficult than shifting from one section of VBA to another, although at the VBA stage you would have to be trained to handle appeals as opposed to just initial claims. But again, at the board stage, we have a limited number of board judges. We have a limited number of board employees. That is a set amount of financing from Congress, and so the Secretary could obviously request more money. The Secretary has requested more money, and we are trying to do this. Part of the reason that the Appeals Modernization Act came into place, part of the reason that the Secretary worked so hard with the VSOs and the non-VSO representatives and Congress is because we recognized that throwing more people at the problem was not necessarily going to solve it, and that there needed to be a comprehensive reform of the system in order to guarantee faster decisions to veterans going forward. We are making efforts to do this. We have worked with Congress to do it. It is a broad programmatic fix, and we have worked with Congress to institute a broad programmatic resolution through the statutes that have been passed.
Just a clarifying point. You mentioned people, AMO people working on ramp issues. Those AMO people, aren't they, they're not necessarily here in D.C., right? Aren't some AMO people scattered throughout the various, aren't there AMO people at each RO?
There are appeals workers at each RO, but the appeals management office is based here in D.C. The individuals who have been doing the first round of RAMP are the individuals who used to receive remands from the board. They retargeted their purposes to focus on the RAMP system.
But they're not AMO personnel. I thought I understood that they were, but I'm just curious.
The ARC individuals who are working at RAMP?
They are all
individuals now who work appeals in the BBA system. They were realigned under AMO. Okay. I believe it was 2 years ago that they did that realignment in order to have greater accountability.
So they are under AMO?
Yes.
Okay. But they're dispersed throughout various ROs?
Some of them.
I have sort of a general question in terms of the, you know, whether this is the appropriate venue and what it might be appropriate for. So we're hearing kind of three different arguments sort of thrown together. In terms of one seems to be almost like a political question, doctrines of separation of powers. This is really something oversight committees should look at. Another is that this may not be a good fit under rules of procedure, writs, and so forth. And the third being, it just might be impractical. And so I'm curious, is the argument really that is a matter of a prudential judgment, it's best for us to leave this alone and leave it to somewhere else to shake out? Or are there limits on our authority that you could point to that would say, no, in this instance, you can't do this or really shouldn't do this because of this rule or this rule?
There's a little bit of both, Your Honor. There are obviously prudential mootness factors in the fact that Congress has acted and that the RAMP program is in place and the Secretary is taking steps toward that. But also there is the fact that the Supreme Court in Norton said that broad programmatic attacks that aren't looking at a discrete issue, but instead an entire system, which is what we're looking at here, are best resolved by the political branches, and here that is Congress and the Secretary, and the group recently acted in August with the goal of addressing these delays in the legacy appeal system and redefining the legacy appeal system. Then there's also the fact that as the deadline, the Supreme Court decision in Heckler v. Day clearly states that a system-wide deadline is inappropriate where Congress has declined to impose one. The legislative history of the legacy appeal system as well as the AMA show that Congress is aware of the delays in the appeal system. Congress has considered the factors that go into that, including the open record system, the role that plays in it, and has also considered specific statutory proposals for a mandatory deadline and also testimony on both sides as to whether a deadline would be appropriate and declined to do so. So the legislative history here is very similar to that was considered by the Supreme Court in Heckler v. Day. So it's the Secretary's position that Heckler v. Day also does control the authority of this court to issue the type of deadline that petitioners are seeking.
You know, I'm glad you got into Heckler v. Day, just moving away from the certification issues for a minute, because I did have a question about that. So in Heckler v. Day, there was a specific explicit repudiation from Congress of deadlines. Ma'am. Has that happened here? It wasn't clear to me. I'm looking on pages 36, 37 of your response to the amended petition. You cite a lot of things about testimony, people saying, it's better if we have, it's better if we don't hurry things up, it's better for veterans if we take our time and do things, and various other testimony.
Yes,
but has Congress actually explicitly repudiated timelines for the VA claims process?
Not in the same language as was used in the Supreme Court decision in Heckler v. Day for Social Security System. However, the repeated acknowledgement of it, the discussion of it, the discussion of the role of the open record system in that put in the delays, the fact that Congress did recently enact a brand new system targeted directly at this, and still not include any delays on the or any deadlines on the Secretary, to us is equally strong legislative history. It would be impossible to have every single statute have the exact same legislative history as was in the case in Heckler, but the legislative history here I believe is every bit as strong as in that case.
In terms of the AMA, the Modernization Act, is it the case that the legacy appeals can't go into that, but they can't be forced into the new system, is that right?
Correct.
And I understand that you have to, the VA, now you personally, you're busy enough, have to submit reports to Congress, I think, on a 90-day basis.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you know if the Secretary has included in any of those reports as a risk, because I think you have to have risk factors with respect to different goals, tried to quantify the risk that this court would order the secretary to do something with the legacy appeals, and because that, it seems to me, that would have a risk of, that would be a risk factor of the plans about how we're planning to do the new thing?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, no, but that doesn't mean that it hasn't been done. I'm just not aware of that. But I do think that it is a significant risk, and as we mentioned in our January 24th response, it is something that this court should take into consideration since the Secretary is making efforts to comply with the new system that was designed by Congress, and we are inviting legacy appellants into that new system to let them avail themselves of the benefits thereof. So to the extent that the Secretary is forced to split between trying to comply with if the court chose to put a mandatory deadline and then trying to comply with what Congress asked us to do, there is going to be a clash of resources and there is going to be a heightened inability of the Secretary to do both. We will try our best to do both. We are trying very hard to adjudicate legacy appeals and we want the Appeals Modernization Act to succeed. It's part of why we pushed so hard and worked so closely with all of the relevant stakeholders to have it happen. But it would be a risk factor if we had to do both at the same time. Your Honor, so turning back to the certification question and the commonality standard, which would be the first standard that is the Secretary's position petitioners don't meet. We concede that petitioners do meet the numerosity standard, but do not believe petitioners meet the commonality, typicality, adequacy of representation, or the B2 standard, which we touched on briefly earlier.
Does the clarification of what decision it is they seek change your response at all?
It does not change the fact that we don't believe that there is commonality. It tweaks our typicality discussion to a certain extent and some of the adequacy discussion doesn't change it, but it does change some of the points that I was going to make, which were related to the issuance of an SOC, as that was our understanding of what they were looking for, since 7105D1 does say that an SOC is a decision, and that is the first post-NOD decision. So it was our understanding that if you're looking for a post-NOD decision within 12 months, you would be looking for an SOC. Also, that is the first step in the appeals process, followed by the notice of, or the Form 9, as I mentioned earlier, and then you get to the board. So we would be sort of bypassing that whole process, which is part of the Appeals Modernization Act.
Well, no, but I think it's still, if somebody is waiting on an SOC, mm-hmm. then it would still apply.
Right.
But you have to add more.
Yeah, it sort of reshapes the question a little bit from my point of view. But on the commonality standard, we think that it still does apply with equal force because of the fact that commonality requires more than just there's a similar legal theory that we're all going under. As the Supreme Court explained in Walmart v. Dukes, while historically there have been a very lenient interpretation of commonality and there have been overly broad classes and general statements that, oh yeah, we have this shared factor, the Supreme Court said in Walmart v. Dukes that there needs to be something more. There needs to be at least one question capable of producing a common answer that will drive the litigation, as you noted earlier.
But why wouldn't, and I'm not saying I've reached this conclusion, mm-hmm. but why wouldn't that common question be, is there an outer limit under the Due Process Clause that simply is too long? Like,
right.
The answer to that question could be no,
mm-hmm.
or it could be yes, and then you'd follow, what is it? But those are, it seems to me, if that is true, then the reasons for the delay may not matter. Right, and so I'm struggling with why it is that wouldn't be a common question under Walmart.
Right. Well, Your Honor, that might be in that circumstance. However, from the issue that was raised by petitioners, that doesn't seem to be the case. And also, since the Supreme Court has noted repeatedly that there isn't necessarily a single answer as to when a case does, well, I guess that actually would answer your common question at that point.
Right, but that is truly what I'm struggling with.
Right.
Right. Because, you know, the answer may be yes, it may be no.
Mm-hmm.
It may be it depends upon the nature of the property interest.
Right.
But, you know, we have some case law here, and we're not bound by it sitting on bonk in
right.
the same way as we would be on a panel. But, you know, Erstbommer says, well, 10 years would be unconstitutional,
mm-hmm.
essentially, mm-hmm. unlawful. Well, that sounds like an absolute rule. It didn't say as long as X, Y, and Z happened. But so my point is, if that's it, doesn't that get you over the commonality threshold? The petitioners may lose substantively, but they'll all go down together in that sense, right?
Right. I mean, it may be, Your Honor, that they do meet the commonality in that hypothetical situation. We would need to receive more briefing on that to assess it more fully, but then we would still have the same question of we still have typicality not satisfied. We still have the adequacy of the representation question coming in. We have the B2 question as to whether there can be a single unified final injunctive order issued by the court that would resolve this for all class members, either a yes or a no. And then we also have the question of whether there is a common refusal or generally applicable refusal to act or action by the secretary. In the case as petitioners have framed it, we have multiple actions by the secretary. We have SOCs, we have SSOCs, we have hearings, we have board hearings, we have development efforts, all of these steps that are being taken by the secretary. And the actual process of applying the legacy appeal system isn't what's generally applicable here. It's the delay, which would be the refusal to act that they're identifying as the generally applicable conduct by the secretary. And that delay is an intensely individualized question. It requires looking at the individual application of the legacy appeal system, the individually applicable, or the individual application of the duty to assist, because that is what ticks the time. That is what sends the time forward. And that is where we would then fail on the generally applicable conduct, generally applicable action or refusal to act by the secretary. So even if we assume commonality was met in that situation, we would still have problems down the line on the certification question.
Wouldn't the commonality, if one accepted that for commonality, working mm-hmm. through this for a second,
yep.
right? So if one accepted, I'm not saying you conceded, you know, cite the transcript or anything, but if we assume that, say, the Constitution says 5 years from beginning to end is unconstitutional, period, it doesn't matter what happens in that time, 5 years, let's just assume that.
Mm-hmm.
If that were deemed to be the common question, wouldn't that also satisfy the 23b2 standard, right? Because the Secretary's common action would be not completing something within 5 years, and the injunction, do it within 5 years, would be generally applicable. I mean, so, because the Supreme Court just last week in a case called Jennings reiterated that the injunction has to apply to everybody. But if that common question is, as we were just talking about, wouldn't the injunction have to be applicable to everybody?
It may be, Your Honor, but then we would also come back to the fact that then there would be due process concerns that would weigh against granting the class in that situation, because if you were making a mandatory injunction and there are individual absentee class members who want that development and want that opportunity to prove their case or want that more time before a decision, which if the case is not fully developed may very well be a denial, you then have the question of, are those individuals adequately represented? Are their interests adequately represented? And that is part of the problem with having a class that is this broad. You have so many different individuals at very different stages in the case who want different things. The legislative histories are replete with testimonies from VSO and non-VSO stakeholders talking about the different interests of every single veteran, talking about the fact that it is a case-by-case analysis, talking about the fact that no two veterans are alike and no two veterans' cases alike. And if you're at the point where at month 11, let's say we do the 12-month standard, month 11, a veteran submits an additional statement or asks us to obtain additional records, and we have to say, no, I'm sorry, there was a mandatory order based on class action that you didn't get notice of and that you didn't get the opportunity to opt out of or opt into, but we are bound by that and we aren't going to give you that more time that you're asking for. We're not going to get those records that you want. We have to deny your claim because it's not supported. That's a problem, and that's something the Secretary is very concerned about with the breadth of the class that petitioners have proposed here. There are so many different individuals with so many different phases and individual concerns and factors, and that is something that having this broad of a class, which is why the Secretary recommended that classes be construed narrowly, it's something that the Secretary hopes the Court does take into consideration.
Ms. Hogan, you mentioned a while back that, to your knowledge, the average processing time from NOD to SOC was about 420 days.
Please, Your Honor.
Did I understand you also to say that you did not have the average processing time for a BVA decision?
I do not have the current up-to-date average processing time for that, Your Honor, no.
Okay. Do you have any average at all?
I believe that the average of time for 2017 was approximately 5.5 to 6 years, if I remember correctly. But it's not something that I double-checked this morning, so it's looking at the SOC.
Right.
Is that from the filing of the NRD, or was that from the filing of the claim?
To be honest, Your Honor, I'm not sure. I'm happy to look at that again, but I was under the impression that we were talking about SOCs today. And I am happy to look at that again.
You mentioned earlier that what I'm looking at is different reasons that might delay a decision. And you mentioned earlier a couple of minutes ago that one of them might be like in month 11, veteran would ask for additional records to be placed in. Are there any, can you give other examples, and I'd be interested in examples where the delay was by the secretary, other than just not being able to get around it, but is there some other delay that might be excusable or prevent, not necessarily excusable, but prevent an issuance within 1 year?
Well, Your Honor, one example would be if there was another government shutdown. We would have a situation where the secretary is not able to work cases during that time, and then there would be, for however long the government was closed, there would be that time period that the secretary was unable to adjudicate those claims. There may be situations where the secretary is faced with a massive influx of new adjudications, which would obviously go more toward the not being able to get to it, but it would be an extenuating circumstances extenuating circumstance, such as when the new Agent Orange regulations went into place a few years ago. There was a massive upsurge in the number of cases that came in, and that became a problem. It could be that there might be a cut in funding, which then would limit the Secretary's ability to reach those cases that wouldn't necessarily be within the Secretary's control. But I guess the easiest example of a situation not within the Secretary's control would be if there was.
And those would apply across the board, though.
They would.
With respect to delays as a result of the veteran, that would be only to the, that delay would only go to that individual veteran at additional records or whatever. What other reasons would there be that the veteran would advance?
An individual veteran may allege worsening of their condition, which then requires the secretary to obtain additional records at that point, a new exam at that point. So that could be a situation. It could be that they have obtained counsel or obtained a different VSO and want more time if they want to prepare for a hearing. We've had issues where, or instances, including in this class, where petitioners requested records and wanted the time to go through those records before they filed their argument to the secretary, either at the VBA stage or the board stage. And so those are situations where the veteran may be involved in making that decision. Or if an individual veteran is going to be indisposed for some reason, whether they were going to be out of the country or if there was an imprisonment situation where they weren't going to be able to receive the decision and file a Form 9 appeal within 60 days, that may be a factor that we would want to take into consideration to if they specifically gave us a heads up and asked us not to adjudicate because they wouldn't be able to respond. That's something we want to take into consideration. So there are many factors. It's part of the reason why the due process analysis does require looking at what those factors are and the reason for the delay. It's why the track analysis requires looking at the secretary's justification and whether the rule of reason shows that there is a reasonable reason for the period of time that's passed. It's why the arbitrary refusal to act standard, again, requires looking at what factors went into why the secretary didn't act. And it's why the reasons are relevant to all of these allegations in this case. And all of those reasons involve the individual application of the legacy appeal system as defined by Congress, based on the class that petitioners have defined here, which is a time, and that's it. It's all we're looking at.
Can you refresh my recollection? Is the timeline that a veteran has to file the Form 9 60 days after the SOC or the remainder of a year from their initial decision? Is that correct?
Yes.
Good, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. That is my recollection as well.
So, counsel, I mean, practically speaking, if the court were to impose a bright line on a constitutional problem of, let's say, 3 years, is there really any situation where reasons don't matter? Don't reasons always matter, even within the 3-year bright line period?
That is the Secretary's understanding of the procedural due process delay analysis, Your Honor, that yes, the reasons are relevant at that time, and that is the third prong of the due process inquiry, is looking at the justification for that delay and the Secretary's interest in the justification for that delay.
So if the court issued an injunctive order that required compliance with a certain time frame,
mm-hmm.
The court has authority under 7265 to imprison and fine the Secretary, right? You understand that?
I do understand that, Your Honor. Hopefully you wouldn't. Hopefully you wouldn't do that, or if you did, hopefully it wouldn't be me. That would be unfortunate. I'd really like to go home at the end of the day, but
I wasn't suggesting that that might happen to you directly, but
but where is Secretary Shulkin?
I mean, you can take Wallace. It's fine.
I think under those circumstances, the reasons for the delay would become important.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree. And also in this court's contempt case law, it says that the reasons are relevant at that point for why we're not complying and if there are budgetary or other limitations that play into it, the reasons are still relevant at that point. Briefly, Your Honors, turning back to the commonality prong again, and assuming outside of the hypothetical of very excited, assuming outside of the hypothetical of there is a endpoint that is always going to be unconstitutional, which it appears that under the Supreme Court's case law and also other relevant case law, there is a question that every single case is case-by-case analysis, and then you do have to look at the evaluation of the reasons and also the factors there. And that was also cited by the court, the Crabell Court, which petitioner cited in their petition for relief. The court there said case-by-case after a full evaluation. But in the Walmart court, the Supreme Court specifically found that that statistics were insufficient to prove commonality there. And just like that, here, averages are insufficient to prove a commonality in this case. The Walmart court explained that the question that would allow for a Title VII claim to be adjudicated on a class basis wasn't how many women were passed over for promotion or whether they were all being considered under Title VII, but instead why they were passed over. And here, under each of the three issues that petitioners have raised, which are track, due process, and Costanza, it's not the how much time has passed that's the relevant question that would drive litigation. It's why that time passed that would drive the litigation. So there are no common answers to that. And also, since we are looking at the writ standard, even assuming that there was a common answer to the clear and indisputable entitlement to a writ, which would go, again, to there's a blanket time that is always going to be unconstitutional, we then have the second prong of the writ factor, which also needs to drive litigation and be answered in common, which is whether there is an alternative form of relief. Petitioners have not identified any answer to whether there is an alternative form of relief or what that may be, and they failed to satisfy commonality, which is their burden to prove. So there is a second reason why we wouldn't meet commonality.
What would be the alternative? I mean, if we again went back to the nasty hypothetical that there is a set period of time when
right.
we don't know anything about detail, right? What would be the alternative remedy?
The alternative remedy here, Your Honor, for a faster decision, which is what I think we would be looking at this point, would be to opt into the ramp system at this point, where the Secretary is implementing the Early Access to the Appeals Modernization Act, and we are issuing decisions with a goal of 125 days, but currently the average is 37.
Except, if I understand ramp, and I'm not saying I do, but if I understand that, it's impossible to get a board decision, at least prior to the board beginning to look at it in February of 2019, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. That is less than 12 months from now, and the board is currently looking at expanding into the ramp program, but as of right now, it is not until 2019 when ramp goes into full effect that you would get a board decision.
But why would this necessarily help if everybody magically went into ramp?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how that helps, because wouldn't we just move the line from here to the next room, and there'd still be a line? Right.
That's true, Your Honor. There is a slight difference in that, where ramp would then be split between the higher level review and
the supplemental
claim, and also the duty to assist applies in a different way in the ramp system, so you don't have that continuing duty. You have the ability to look at the record, a closed record system, which is what this court uses and also what most appellate courts uses, where you have that set record, and that's what you're looking at, and that's what you're assessing to see if there was an error in that initial adjudication, which isn't the case in the legacy appeal system. The legacy appeal system is constantly open, constantly changing and developing. So that's sort of where the time comes in and where that factor is different.
Yeah, but in looking at that as an alternative to issuing a writ here, mm-hmm. isn't it true that in order to get on the ramp, you have to give up some procedural and substantive rights?
Yes, Your Honor. It is that the ramp program is you are opting into the Appeals Modernization Act system, which is different than the legacy appeal system and does have different duty to assist requirements. You still have the same protection, actually a greater protection of your earlier effective date, or your not earlier effective date, it is your effective date at that point. You have that protection, and you can, by opting into the supplemental claim line, continue to have the duty to assist attach and have development in that way. But if you do opt into the supplemental claim line, it is then a closed record.
Uh-huh. Right. So you're giving up some rights.
If you opt into the supplemental claim line, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. So we would have to take that into account in assessing whether that was a true, viable alternative.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. But the fact is that whether it is on the merits, there's still the fact that there's no common answer as to whether there is or is not a answer there, because there is for some individuals as they're being invited in, but petitioners have not identified any common answer that would drive that stage of the litigation, which is the second prong of the merits issue. I see that my timer just went automatically to the 19. Sorry, good to go. All right, caught me off guard a little bit. Turning to the adequacy, the typicality prong, which is the third prong.
Counsel, before you go there, these are commonality and typicality, I guess, are kind of overlap a little bit. But my among many problems that I have, one of my concerns about this is the approach that we're taking. And I heard you loud and clear about working with constituency groups and working with the VSOs and all the in Congress and trying to develop fixes to this system. But in some respects, I guess a metaphor I might use is a tire, right? Maybe not a great metaphor, but a metaphor in any event. You can put a lot of miles on that tire, right? Have you ever had a flat tire?
I have, AAA.
All right. So you run it, and you run it, and you run it, and it wears down after a while. And you can patch it. I just put two patches on one of my tires. But you patch it, and you patch it, and ultimately you need to get a new tire.
Yes.
And it seems to me this system has been patched and run and patched and run, and maybe we need something entirely different and entirely new. So I'm not certain that, and I don't think anybody knows yet, that the ramp system will work, will expedite these claims. We do know that the averages have continued to, of time processing, have continued to increase, and that's a problem. But I'm just curious if there are any creative fixes to the timelines that we might be able to impose on the Secretary. Have you all given that any thought?
Well, Your Honor, the entire plan behind the Appeals Modernization Act was actually to avoid what you're talking about with the patching the broken tire and the redesigned system that all the parties got together and agreed upon is actually a complete rewrite of the system as opposed to just another patch on that tire, which it seems that maybe trying to slap a mandatory deadline on there may just be another example of patching that tire, plugging that hole, trying to get a few more miles out of it, when there are options available, which do include ramp, which the Secretary worked very, very hard with the interested parties to design the Appeals Modernization Act, which this is simply an early opportunity to get into the Appeals Modernization Act. I know that a lot of amici pointed out it's a temporary system and that is a flaw, but it's only temporary because the Appeals Modernization Act is coming along. It's going to be here next year, and then it'll be permanent. It's going to be the new system, and there won't be any more opt-ins through RAMP. You'll be opting in through the Appeals Modernization System, which was designed to have those opt-in spurs along the way. The goal is to give everyone the opportunity to get the new system, the brand new tire, as opposed to the old patch tire, which is the legacy appeal system, which the Secretary recognizes there are flaws in it. We have asserted that in our pleading. We've said it on the record multiple times. The Secretary doesn't disagree that there are flaws in the legacy appeal system. It's just that the legacy appeal system is designed to be what it is, and it is designed to pretty much never have that end point if an individual veteran wants to keep their claim going. If a veteran receives an SOC and decides, I'm out, I don't want this appeal anymore, they can step out at any phase. But at the same time, if the veteran wants to keep their case going and they have new evidence or they have an allegation of worsening, they can submit that evidence, and it does require the TURN. The TURN is built into the legacy appeals system. It's not something the Secretary is imposing on the system. It's the design of the system.
Yeah, well, you know, with the backlog of 470,000 cases, it seems to me that the Secretary has to think about global resolution mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of ADR system in place at the department, or, I don't know, payment and waiver system of claims? Is there anything like that in place or being discussed, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, but I'm not privy to everything.
Right.
But to my knowledge, that is not something that is currently taking place.
Thank you.
Yes, actually, at this point, if there's nothing further.
I just have one question. Just one quick one.
You're right on that.
Does the Secretary stand by the position that Simpson, Thatcher, and Yale Law School are inadequate class representatives? I mean, not class representatives, class counsel.
Your Honor, we do not think that the interests of the class as a whole are being adequately represented by the class that was framed here and the petition that was filed here. We do not think that it adequately covers all the interests of the absentee class members, which include individuals who want to have their claim fully developed before it's adjudicated, and it also is in conflict with the statements of VSOs and non-VSO representatives that there is no quick fix to the system, that there are lasting concerns related to trying to patch another hole in a different way. And it was nothing that we said was intended to be a personal attack on Yale Law School and Simpson Thatcher.
And I have no connection with Yale Law School or Simpson Thatcher. But I will tell you from my own perspective that I'm not aware of any case out there that conflates the fact that a class definition might not be correct with pegging the inadequacy of counsel without more. And just from my perspective, that undermined some arguments of the Secretary where I think there were legitimate disputes. I think this is not even a close question if we were to have to reach there.
Yes, so, Your Honor. It was more the focus on the type of resolution that was being proposed, which would be scrapping the system from and including eliminating this court as opposed to intended to be anything of a personal smart.
I didn't think it was personal smart.
Okay.
I'm just saying that,
yes.
it's difficult for me to imagine that in a class action world, you know, a top, whatever, 50 law firm that does class action work would not be deemed to be inadequate.
For a class, Your Honor, yes, we agree, but our concern is more with the knowledge with the Veterans Appeals System and the Legacy Appeals System and the structure there. There were specific instances in the pleading that represented a misunderstanding of the legacy appeal system, and if you were trying to bind all 500,000 individuals in the legacy appeal system to a specific response, that is something that we think the court should take into account, whether there is familiarity, appropriate and necessary familiarity with that system and with the multiple voices that represent that system.
Ms. Hogan, in this context, could a precedential decision accomplish what petitioners would like to accomplish through a class action?
No, we think that it could. We think that the court has the ability to issue guidance that would provide both the opportunity for individuals to distinguish their case or to not pursue it or to waive it, as petitioner's counsel indicated, as well as to provide the guidance necessary for this court to declare what would be a constitution or what is an unconstitutionally long period of time if it chose to go that way. However, as the Secretary did note in our pleadings, there is the fact that this court is not supposed or should decline to rule on the constitutional issue where there are statutory grounds for the same decision to be reached, which here would be looking at the 7261 unreasonable delay standard. So it would be our position that the court should not reach the constitutional issue, but if it did reach the constitutional issue, a precedential decision would still bind the Secretary, but would allow individual veterans to use that waiver without having the final injunctive order problem.
I had a really quick question. I know this wasn't briefed extensively, but it was mentioned earlier this morning. Would the Secretary have any position specific to omnibus-style, you know, relief? I mean, I know it's a different animal, but I'm assuming, obviously, the Secretary would be against it, but I was wondering if there's any insight as to why, specifically.
Yes, Your Honor. We are of the position that if the goal of the court is to achieve expediency and consistency and all of those sides of the class action, that the omnibus would come into play in a negative light, since it would not be binding everywhere. It would give the initial recommendation decision, and then you would still have to apply that to each case.
It could address a lot of, I mean, you're talking about the injunctions, whether they would apply to everybody, and if they wanted to sort of further development, that would create a problem. I mean, omnibus could at least address some of those concerns.
It could to a certain extent, Your Honor, but then we also have the fact that most of the time an omnibus is used in resolving serious factual issues, such as in the
factual in the sense of the claim, you know, the claim lasted 4 years because the veteran requested repeated redevelopment, right? Versus, you know, the veteran did everything they needed to do and just sat there on somebody's desk.
Right.
That's a big factual question about a due process claim.
That could be a framework that this court may want to consider. It's something that if you did, the Secretary would obviously be willing to look into further. However, at this point, we don't think that it is the appropriate tool, since it does simply just add another stage that then would lead to further litigation down the road before the court, and sort of errs more on the side of the trial court as opposed to the appellate body, which is what this court was designed to be. So that's where we're coming from on that point of view.
Thank you, Counsel.
Yes, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to begin by returning to Judge Meredith's questions about the ability of this court to modify and this shape the class definition as proposed by petitioners. Petitioners recognize, as this court has acknowledged, that we are all in uncharted waters, and that the path forward involves first setting the standard the petitioners must meet in order to show that they meet the standard for class aggregation in this court. And this court's analysis of the matter will be best served by setting the standard first and then allowing petitioners to meet that standard by clarifying and, if need be, modification through subsequent class certification motions or other pleadings before this court. We're all working to assess whether these delays at the VA are acceptable and whether they are lawful. And in order for this court to best address these questions and to determine whether the actions of the Secretary have, in fact, been unreasonably delayed, as Judge Allen mentioned, questions on the merits, this court should allow petitioners the opportunity to meet the standard it sets for class certification before deciding on the matter. I'd also like to return to the court's discussion of Heckler v. Day. In the first instance, I'd like to point out that the court did not reflect on the constitutional issue in the Heckler case. It was a matter of statutory interpretation under Title II of the Social Security Act. And as Judge Bartley, you pointed out, relied heavily on the very specific and express rejection of statutory deadlines that Congress came to. In fact, here the record is not equally clear and the record is not equally strong. As the Supreme Court has cautioned, the failure to implement laws and the failure to pass laws provide a dubious ground for gleaning congressional intent. The fact that Congress simply has not passed laws imposing deadlines should not suggest that Congress has expressly rejected them in the same way that they did in the Heckler v. Day case. So first, if this court does come to the conclusion, as Judge Allen suggested, hypothetically could, that there is an outer bound to the amount of time that it could take to process a veteran's claim, Heckler should not provide a restraint on that decision that due process clause has been violated at a certain point.
Excuse me, if I can interject you back to your first point, yeah, that you should be given an opportunity to respond to whatever standard we sent. In the questions that we sent out to the parties, we identified the Rule 23 factors. So if we were to adopt those factors, haven't you already had a chance to respond to them?
That's correct, Your Honor. However, there has been no full standard set. We believe that on the papers, as my colleagues have argued, petitioners do meet the commonality, typicality, adequacy, and numerosity prongs under the Rule 23A and the injunctive relief prong of Rule 23B2. However, in the full interest of fairness to both parties, the parties should have the opportunity, once a standard is fully set, to meet that standard and to argue whether the class resolution is appropriate. Here, but to repeat, we do believe that on our papers before this court and the facts as disclosed in the Secretary's public records, public reports, petitioners do meet the commonality standard. And that is because, as the Ninth Circuit found post-Dukes in Parsons v. Ryan, even though the nature of the individual harms may differ, where the conduct is traceable to the unified policies and practices of a government body that expose the full class to the risks of constitutional deprivations. There it was the Eighth Amendment, and the court rejected a similar argument that Eighth Amendment violations require an individualized inquiry into every instance. Here, the problem is pervasive and applies to all petitioners and the class members who they represent, who enter this system and seek to have what we posit is an entitlement to a timely adjudication of their appeals.
Is there a way for you to prevail, for a petitioner to prevail on class certification, on commonality, if in fact my musings about there being an outer limit beyond which simply you are in unconstitutional land, if that's not right, is there any way to satisfy commonality in your case?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so. The question might be whether every veteran is entitled to a timely adjudication, and that timely adjudication might be a 1 year or 5 years. But assuming, as in Derwinski, that there is an outer limit, this court has already held that 10 years would be unacceptable. And I believe that under the Due Process Clause, some time limit must be unreasonable under this court's statutes and the Due Process Clause. That commonality exists where petitioners are exposed to that harmful, unlawful delay in the process that prevents them from receiving the entitlement.
But if, and I'm going to take a leap in the Secretary's argument here, right, we're going to put that hypothetical aside, right, and so it's totally wrong, just musings. And now it matters why your case is delayed. Right? Let's just assume that now is the constitutional rule. If that were the rule, and so if you waited 4 years, you couldn't answer the question of whether that's too long, because you'd have to say, why did it take too long? If that were the analysis, is there a way to prevail on commonality? That's what I'm looking for.
Yes, Your Honor. As petitioners have argued, we believe that there are parts of the VA's appeals system that are simply taking too long, and that veterans are waiting too long to receive a decision, regardless of their contribution to that delay and whether or not they've requested, for example, additional evidentiary development or a postponed hearing. The Secretary's process, and I'd like to return briefly to the broad nature of our class. The fact that some veterans might be delayed in the 500 days it takes them to receive a statement of the case from the timely filing of their NOD, or the 3 years, as was the case in eBank, that it might take for a veteran to receive a hearing at the board, the delays in this process pervade the system and ultimately trace back to the Secretary's management and implementation of its mission and its failure to provide the timely adjudication at each of those stages. So we believe that the petitioners have shown that the harm is fairly traceable, as the commonality requirement requires, to the actions of the Secretary in causing the delay that is not actually attributable to the veterans themselves. Alternatively, as going back to Judge Meredith's point, if the court does find that there are specific instances where the the Secretary truly can show no justification for delay. For example, while cases are sitting in case storage at the board where no fact development is ongoing, this court has the authority and discretion to certify subclasses, and petitioners would be prepared to brief and discuss the implementation of subclasses that could more targetedly address the court's concerns.
Why didn't you do that in your second, in your amendment of your petition?
Your Honors, we did not know the standard the court planned to adopt at the time we amended our petition. The court had not yet set a framework for the petitioners to meet, and we believe that...
Did you have a clue?
We had some indications. The court had asked us about Rule 23 and whether we met that standard. However, we thought that the appropriate course of action was to simply modify our petition in a more narrow way than reframing the entire litigation through subclasses, and that we would have the opportunity, once a standard was set,
I'm sorry, I need to clarify. You think your amendment narrowed?
Sorry, I misspoke, Your Honor. Okay. We didn't want to modify the class in that broad of a way before we had the opportunity to learn what the actual framework would be. Petitioners believe and continue to maintain that the appropriate course of action, and we recommend this court takes it, is to set the standard first and then adjudicate whether petitioners meet that standard.
So once you have the standard set, are you suggesting there could be an amendment to the petition?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that given that we're all just figuring out how this process is going to work, and we're all interested in assessing fully and adequately whether these delays are lawful or unreasonable, petitioners should have the opportunity to meet the standard once this court sets it, and that would provide all parties with the most fair resolution of these claims in the court, the most full opportunity to adjudicate and address the claims. I'd also like to quickly return to the 23B2 analysis that Judge Allen discussed. I'd just like to return to the specific question about waiver, and that, in fact, we do not believe that if a veteran, should this court decide there is some outer limit, and that veterans nonetheless could waive that their entitlement or right to a decision within that time frame, that the court would need to be involved in every instance of that waiver. Rather, we believe that should this court grant class certification and find liability and ultimately order relief, that should come in the form, or could come in the form, of an implementation plan that gradually implements the relief, and that in part of that plan, the court could approve and the secretary could implement an option for veterans who seek to waive the Monk Rule to do so without involving this court in the day-to-day operations of the secretary's adjudications.
But the secretary would still need to assess that the case was ready to be decided, or that the deadline was approaching, contact the veteran would need to respond that they seek a waiver.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So all those steps would be taking the secretary out of the decision-making efforts into the management efforts.
Potentially, Your Honor. I don't know the precise contours of the implementation plan that could be adopted down the road. We believe that the secretary could implement those procedures and would have the discretion and flexibility to do so, and that this court, where the point was, would not need to be involved in those day-to-day adjudications or determinations. Also, to return to the question about congressional action and the implementation of the Appeals Modernization Act, any effect that might have on the current backlog is entirely speculative, and this court has the authority and mandate from Congress to compel action that is already unreasonably delayed. Petitioners maintain that the fact that they have waited this long for decisions on their appeals post-NOD is an ongoing constitutional and statutory violation that warrants this court's intervention. Regardless of the potential speculative effects that the Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act might have on those claims, the fact remains that petitioners and the members of the class have suffered those harms and are entitled to judicial remedy if the court were to decide that the law was broken. Also, on the question of precedential decisions that came up in the last discussion, petitioners maintain that there is a vast difference between this court's issuance of a precedential decision in a case and a class action decision. Class action decisions allow for the implementation of affirmative relief. It's true that where a decision simply involves the declaration that a statute or a law is unlawful, for example, there may not be the need to further monitor or implement relief. However, here where the court's order would involve the potential oversight and implementation of reforms at the VA to comply with the order, a class action provides more meaningful accountability because the members of the class can enforce their rights more directly without needing to go through an entire administrative adjudication process. And would also eliminate the possibility for future mooting out of claims as they come to vindicate their rights to this court. I'd also like to return to the Your Honor's questions about collateral effects of a court order here. If the court does determine that there's a constitutional violation here, it's well-settled law that resource constraints and justifications based on extents cannot justify a court's failure to act in the face of those constitutional violations. In Watson v. Memphis, the Supreme Court made clear that institutional resource constraints cannot justify an ongoing deprivation of constitutional rights. If the court has no further questions, I know it's been a long morning, I'd like to quickly conclude.
You may.
Mr. Monk sits here today as he and hundreds of thousands of veterans like him have sat for years waiting. The Secretary has admitted that there are unlawful and unacceptable delays ongoing at the VA and that these multi-year delays in many instances are unacceptable. And yet, the Secretary suggests to this court that it has no role to play in the resolution or remedy of those harms. But Congress has spoken to the issue of unreasonable delay, and this court, as the only court with the power to compel action of the Secretary that is unreasonably delayed, should fulfill its statutory mandate to do so here. As the Federal Circuit remarked in eBanks, the best and indeed maybe the only way for this court to effectively, fairly, efficiently, and accountably implement and adjudicate these claims is through the adoption and use of a class aggregation framework. Petitioners and amici as petitioners and amici urge this court to do in adopting that framework, all parties to the proceedings essentially agree that Rule 23 provides the clearest path forward if the court were to implement a class procedure. And for today, petitioners ask that this court only take that first step towards resolving these claims in announcing the standard that petitioners must meet in order to obtain class certification, and then allowing them to meet that standard in order to ultimately prove that they're entitled to the relief they seek. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you all. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down to Greek Council.